Chapter 4 Hope and Coming to America. China has a million companies that want to sell abroad, but they don't know how. Jack Ma. In January 1994, at the age of 29, Jack founded the Hangzhou Haibo Translation Agency. When the company first started, there were only 5 staff members, mostly retired teachers from the institute. He rented 2 rooms at 27 Qinyan Road, not far from Westlake, in a converted church that once housed the YMCA. Today, the sign for Hope Translation still hangs outside, where the translation agency maintains a meeting room adjacent to what has become the YMCA International Youth Hostel. Jack convinced some students from his English night school to lend a hand with the business, largely to help find his first clients. On opening day, his students went to Wulin Square with banners to help publicize the company. A few of these students ended up joining the company full-time. One of the early employees was Jern Hong. She met Jack in 1993 when he was teaching advanced oral English at the YMCA. She recalled, "Nobody else saw the opportunity in this business. We didn't make much money at first, but Jack persevered. I respect him tremendously, for he has a great ability to motivate people, and he can invest things that seem hopeless with exciting possibility. He can make those around him get excited about life." Jack's first business was focused on helping local companies find customers overseas. Jack later recalled, "I had to teach during the day and had no time to help others do translation work, but lots of retired teachers had nothing to do at home, and their pension was low, so I wanted to found a translation company to be an intermediary. With its narrow focus on translation, Jack would not find commercial success with Hope. But his first venture gave him direct exposure to the entrepreneurial revolution that was transforming Zhejiang and his first tentative steps as an entrepreneur himself. The Chinese word for hope was haibo, which literally translates as vast like the sea. Popular slang for leaving a government job and entering the private sector at the time was to xia hai, or to jump into the sea. Jack wanted to get his feet wet as an entrepreneur, but he wasn't quite ready to take the plunge and abandon his public sector job as a teacher. Entrepreneurship is such a well-established part of modern Chinese business and culture today that it is easy to forget how much things have changed in the last few decades. In the earliest days of China's economic reforms, entrepreneurship was viewed as a highly risky, even illegal undertaking. Memories then were fresh of those imprisoned or even executed during the Cultural Revolution for carrying out commercial activities. From 1978, the establishment of a household contract responsibility system allowed farmers to sell surplus crops on the open market. The first embers of private business started to grow with the Township and Village Enterprises, TVEs. The TVEs were nominally state-controlled, but in effect privately run rural enterprises. The spark was lit for a rapid expansion of private sector employment in China. From the early 1980s, the Chinese government began to recognize entrepreneurs, first individual entrepreneurs, then businesses run by entrepreneurs. The first entrepreneurs, the Gertehu, were not leaving behind a stable government job, but rather were those with nothing to lose. They were mostly agricultural laborers, their low status inviting the pejorative association of peddlers. As they grew richer, they were resented and mocked for their success and lack of class. One early Gertehu even papered the walls of his home with banknotes. Some of the richest business people in China today started out as lowly Gertehu, many in Zhejiang province. To understand Alibaba's rise, it is helpful to understand how Jack's home province became the source of so much wealth. Zhejiang, China's crucible of entrepreneurship. Hangzhou, the nearby port of Ningbo, and other industrial clusters dotting northern Zhejiang and southern Jiangsu provinces form the economic powerhouse of the Yangtze River Delta, with Shanghai as its center. Home to Alibaba's e-commerce empire, Hangzhou has a long tradition as a trading center. The city once served as the southernmost point of the 1,100-mile-long Grand Canal, whose full name in Chinese is Jinghan Da Yunhe, or the Beijing-Hangzhou Grand Canal. For more than 1,000 years, the Grand Canal was the main trading artery between South and North China, making Hangzhou one of the most prosperous cities in China. Hangzhou and the nearby port of Ningbo lie on relatively flat land. But most of Zhejiang Province is mountainous, its elevations and rivers creating a patchwork of isolated communities and dialects. The need to trade and the distance from the country's political rulers have helped make Zhejiang the cradle of private enterprise in China. Today, many of the province's entrepreneurs sit atop China's rich list. Most, like Jack, started out living hardscrabble lives. Zhong Qingho, worth more than $11 billion, is the founder of Wahaha, China's largest beverage manufacturer. From the age of 4, Zhong grew up in Hangzhou, later working on a salt farm on an island off the coast of Ningbo before graduating from secondary school. In the 1980s, he sold ice pops on the street for less than a penny. Li Shufu, worth more than $2 billion, founded Geely, China's first non-state-owned car manufacturer. He started out assembling refrigerators using spare parts, then in 1988 founded Geely. In 2010, Geely purchased Sweden's Volvo Cars. Liu Gongqiu, worth more than $7 billion, is the founder of Wanxiang Group, the Hangzhou-based auto parts manufacturer. He started out as a farmer, then started buying scrap metal from villagers. Jack's friend Gua Guancheng, a man worth an estimated $7 billion before his unexplained disappearance for several days in December 2015, is the founder of investment firm Fosun. Gua survived the Cultural Revolution only by eating moldy, dried vegetables, later winning entry to Shanghai's prestigious Fudan University, where he sold bread door-to-door in the dorms to make ends meet. Prior to his surprise absence in 2015, Fosun had been described by the Financial Times as the Berkshire Hathaway of China. Gua is an active supporter of Alibaba's forays into logistics and finance. As we saw in the logistics edge of the Iron Triangle, one cluster of Zhejiang's entrepreneurs has played an important role in Alibaba's success. The Tonglu gang of logistics companies located in the town of Tonglu, to the southwest of Hangzhou, account for more than half of all package deliveries in China. Tonglu was the birthplace of the late Nie Tengfei, founder of courier giant Shentong, STO Express. Born into poverty, Nie raised pigs, planted grain, and sold firewood before moving to Hangzhou to work in a printing factory. He moonlighted as a courier delivering bread on his tricycle before spotting an opportunity at the age of 20 to beat China Post, delivering customs forms for trading companies to Hangzhou, to the port in Shanghai. Nie died in a car crash in 1998, but Shentong continued to thrive. Two of Nie's relatives and one of his classmates each founded three other large courier companies in the Tonglu gang. Hangzhou, the provincial capital, and Ningbo, its largest port, have long been prosperous trading centers. But two other cities in Zhejiang, Wenzhou and Yiwu, though less well-known overseas, are renowned in China for their newfound wealth. Wenzhou helped legitimize the role of entrepreneurs in society, and Yiwu established the wholesale markets that extended their reach to all parts of the country and, indeed, the world. Wenzhou and Yiwu have played as important a part in China's entrepreneurial revolution as the cotton mills of Lancashire did in Britain's Industrial Revolution. Wenzhou and Yiwu provided the dynamism that inspired Jack to launch his own entrepreneurial career. Innovations in Wanzhou opened the door for Alibaba's future forays into financial services, and the massive wholesale market in Yiwu was a template for Alibaba's first business model, connecting merchants in China with global buyers. Let us take a brief tour. Wenzhou. Wenzhou lies 200 miles southeast of Hangzhou. Hemmed in by mountains on one side and the East China Sea on the other, Wenzhou has always looked to trade, including tea exports, for its livelihood. But after 1949, its proximity to nationalist Taiwan became a liability. With Shanghai a 300-mile ferry ride away, the city suffered from its isolation. Wenzhou had little arable land and many unemployed or underemployed agricultural workers. But once Deng Xiaoping launched his economic reforms in 1978, the private sector started to boom. Wenzhou's entrepreneurs, often working with family members, started out in light manufacturing. In the 1980s, they were some of the first merchants to fan out across China to sell their wares, including knockoffs of Western brands. For many, Chinese goods from Wenzhou were the first items they ever purchased that were not made by the state. Wenzhou has played a pivotal role in legitimizing entrepreneurship in China. In 1984, the Wenzhou municipal government invited the city's most successful private entrepreneurs to a conference. Although the government wanted to help them showcase their success, many entrepreneurs refused to attend, fearing arrest. Only 2 years earlier, a number of entrepreneurs in the city had been arrested for speculation. They still languished in prison. Of the entrepreneurs who showed up for the meeting with the government, a number brought along their toothbrushes in case they too were detained. But the entrepreneurs were not jailed. After releasing those arrested 2 years earlier, the Wenzhou government published an unprecedented admission in local newspapers that it had erred. Professor Yasheng Huang at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology writes that many entrepreneurs cited these two episodes as having convinced them of their personal security. For decades in China, the country's state-owned banks ignored private enterprises and individuals, making politically directed loans to the state-owned enterprises, SOEs. Starved for lending, the private sector in Wenzhou began to devise its own private credit market, often adopting illegal structures. The local government actively supported the establishment of private credit associations, cooperatives, and money houses, a form of local financial broker that derives profits from the spread between rates of interest on deposits and loans, forming a system that came to be known as the Wenzhou model. Wenzhou paved the way for Alibaba's own foray into banking. When Alibaba received its banking license in 2014, two of the other five recipients were from Wenzhou. Raw entrepreneurial spirit, plus access to capital, fueled an explosion in the city's private sector, which so dominated Wenzhou's economy that the state became completely marginalized. Facing a huge demand for new roads and bridges, the entrepreneurs of Wenzhou didn't wait for funds or instructions from Beijing. They simply built their own, in a surge of construction that bordered on anarchy, lacking any coordinated plan. In 1990, acting on their own, entrepreneurs even funded the construction of the city's airport. 1 year later, the country's first private carrier, Juneyao Airlines, was launched in the city. In 1998, Wenzhou created China's first privately funded railroad. Today in China, Wenzhou is synonymous with wealth. The city's residents are resented by some for their mass shopping sprees, always paying cash, which have driven up the prices of apartments in Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, New York City, and beyond. Yiwu. Yiwu is an unlikely location for one of the world's key trading nodes. It is located inland, far from Hangzhou, Ningbo, or the East China Sea. Like Wenzhou, it was dirt poor with little cultivable land. Lacking any alternative, local farmers since the 16th century turned to trade. Their main product was brown sugar, which they cooked with ginger and cut into chunks. This they bartered for chicken feathers, which they used to make feather dusters, or mulched to make fertilizer. In the winters, when the farmers had little to do and food was scarce, local men would hoist a pole with bamboo baskets on their shoulders and travel the country as peddlers. They carried out sugar chunks, sewing needles, and thread, and brought chicken feathers back to Yiwa. As they walked, they would use a rattle drum to attract customers. They became known as sugar shoulder pole men, a precursor to today's million-strong courier workforce. Soon there were so many itinerant merchants in Yiwa that they formed a veritable mobile army. To supply them with wares in the 1700s, the first wholesale markets started to appear in the city. Trade flourished for centuries until the dislocation of the Japanese invasion and communist revolution. When Deng Xiaoping's reforms started to take effect, the wholesale trade came out of the shadows. In September 1982, traders in Yiwa were allowed access to a patch of land, a ditch that they had first cemented over, to set up their stalls. 700 stalls popped up almost immediately, and Yiwa became one of the first wholesale markets of its kind in post-revolutionary China. Today, the city is home to the largest wholesale market in the world, and its population has shot up to over 2 million people. An estimated 40,000 people visit the wholesale market every day. The 700 stalls have become 70,000 outlets, housed today inside the Yiwa International Trade Center. This colossal building spans more than 40 million square feet, generating a turnover of more than $6 billion per year. On sale inside are an estimated 1.7 million products, from toys to plastic flowers, jewelry to suitcases, clothing to home appliances, anything and everything that is made in China. Without knowing it, a huge amount of what we consume in the West has passed through Yiwa. Even Christmas is made in Yiwa. More than 60% of the world's Christmas decorations are manufactured in the city. Although traders travel there overwhelmingly for its cheap prices, part of Yiwa's attraction has been its supply of counterfeit products. For example, handbags sold under the almost familiar-sounding names such as Goosey. The Financial Times journalist James Kinge traveled to the city in 2005 to research the problem of fake goods, only to find out that even hotels there were fake. He passed by not the Hyatt, but the Hayat. Yiwa attracts traders from all four corners of the world. The town is a favorite of traders from the Middle East, making Yiwa home to the fastest-growing Muslim community in China. With an estimated 35,000 Muslims in the city at any time, Chinese, South Asian, and Arab, Yiwa features dozens of Muslim restaurants and an ornate $4 million mosque featuring marble imported from Iran. Since 2014, Yiwa is the start of the longest freight railroad line in the world. Taking 21 days to traverse end-to-end, the 8,111-mile line links Yiwa with Madrid. What makes Yiwa such an essential node is its role marketing the goods of the countless industrial clusters of Zhejiang and other parts of the Yangtze River Delta. These single-product towns can represent 80% or more of the production of individual commodities, not just in China, but worldwide. Shaoxing is textile city, and Yongkang is hardware city, churning out 30,000 steel doors and 150,000 motor scooters every day. Taizhou is known as sewing machine city, and Shenzhou as necktie city. Haining calls itself Leather City. There is even a toothbrush city. In case nervous entrepreneurs get a summons from their local government official, in Hangzhi. Yiwa itself claims to be China's sock city, producing annually more than 3 billion pairs of socks for companies like Walmart and Disney. Although Datong, near Hangzhou, also claims to be sock city, producing more than 8 billion pairs each year. By the mid-1990s, when Jack was starting his own business career, Zhejiang was already an entrepreneurial powerhouse. but the province's companies were highly labor-intensive and their average size small. From hardly any entrepreneurs at the beginning of the 1980s, by 1994, Zhejiang arguably had too many. In a population of 44 million people, the province was home to an estimated 10 million economic entities. Many manufacturers struggled to find enough customers to make a profit. Unlike the factories in southern China set up by wealthy overseas Chinese in Hong Kong and Taiwan, the small factories in Zhejiang had to hustle to find customers and finance. China's state-owned banks denied them any credit. This chronic lack of funding created innovations in private finance, such as the Wenzhou model, and led to the rise of industrial clusters that bound together debtors and creditors who could dole out capital based on the profit they believed would be generated by a specific contract. By 2004, of the top 100 largest domestic private firms in China, half came from Zhejiang province. Jack recognized early on both the region's strengths and its shortcomings, and is a proud advocate for the province. Since October 2015, he serves as the inaugural chairman of the General Association of Zhejiang Entrepreneurs. In his inaugural speech, Jack talked about the 6 million Zhejiang entrepreneurs in China and the 2 million Zhejiang entrepreneurs around the world. The total number of over 8 million Zhejiang entrepreneurs might be the largest business association in the world. They have created another economic entity in addition to the local economy in Zhejiang. Their successes weren't won easily, though. In an earlier speech to the Zhejiang Chamber of Commerce, Jack summed up the dynamism of his home province. As entrepreneurs from Zhejiang, our greatest advantages are that we are hardworking, courageous, and good at seizing opportunities. We have these excellent qualities because we were given nothing. We are not like other provinces, which have resources of coal and ore. We Zhejiang entrepreneurs have markets. As long as we are in places where there are people, we are always able to find opportunities. It will be the same in the future. Yet Jack's first effort to tap into Zhejiang's entrepreneurial fizz was not a success. In 1994, his Hope Translation venture had gotten off to a troubled start. While his monthly office rent was almost $300, his first month's income was just over $20. Hope may spring eternal, but cash is king. Jack was facing a crunch. To support his venture, Jack started peddling goods on the streets of Hangzhou, including some he sourced from Yiwu. His translation company also became a trading company. Hope Translation Agency started to sell gifts, flowers, books, and even plastic carpet, a range of items that foreshadows Taobao. Jack recalled, "We did everything. This income supported the translation agency for 3 years until we started to make ends meet. We believed that as long as we kept doing it, we would definitely have a future." But it was becoming clear to Jack that translation services alone were not going to sate his entrepreneurial ambitions. Soon, an unexpected journey, which looked at first like a disaster, was about to give Jack a lucky break. With his reputation as an expert English speaker growing from his popular evening classes and his Hope Translation venture, Jack was asked by the government of Tonglu County, some 50 miles to the southwest of Hangzhou, and later home to the Tonglu gang of logistic companies, to assist as an interpreter in helping resolve a dispute with an American company over the construction of a new highway. In 1994, the company had proposed to invest in a new highway to be built from Hangzhou to Tonglu. After a year of negotiations, no agreement had been reached, and the initial funding promised by the partner in the United States had not materialized. Jack was tapped to find out what was going on and, hopefully, end the deadlock. First, Jack traveled to Hong Kong, where he was told that the company's funds were held in the United States. So Jack embarked on his first trip there. He would stay for a month. His mission for the Tonglu government was a failure, but the trip would give him his first exposure to the internet, and he would return to China a changed man. Going to America. His first trip to America, sounds more like a plot for an Ocean's 11-style crime caper than an interpreter's business trip, at least according to the version put out 5 years later during the dot-com boom when media started to take an interest in Jack's background. Upon arriving in Los Angeles, the story goes, Jack met with the unnamed boss of Tonglu's erstwhile U.S. partner. Jack quickly figured out, as The Economist related, that the company he was investigating did not exist, that his host was a crook, and that he himself was in serious danger. Jack has never named the boss, later described in local media only as a bulky Californian. But after refusing to take a bribe, Jack recalled he was locked in a beach house in Malibu, where his captor flashed a gun. He was then taken to Las Vegas, where he was kept in a form of house arrest in a hotel room on the top floor of a casino. Jack hasn't repeated the details of any of this in recent years. His personal assistant, Chen Wei, has written that it is an episode that Jack prefers to forget. A few years after the incident, when Alibaba was beginning to gain international prominence, Jack told a similar story to Melinda Liu, the Beijing bureau chief for Newsweek. I flew to Hangzhou for an exclusive interview with Jack, and he spent a generous amount of time showing me around the Alibaba headquarters and talking at length about his life. He said that, on his very first visit to the USA, a former business contact, an American, had virtually kidnapped him in a failed attempt to get Jack to work for him. At the time, Jack was pretty matter-of-fact, and the anecdote was just one of many he recounted. I later contacted him requesting more information. He indicated he didn't want to make too much of it and declined to provide additional details. The bizarre story ends with Jack escaping his hotel room and winning $600 on slot machines in the casino. Abandoning his belongings upstairs, he escapes the casino and buys an airline ticket for Seattle. A less colorful version of the story was detailed in an article published in September 1995 in the Hangzhou Daily, which says Jack had taken along $4,000 in savings and money borrowed from his wife Kathy's mother and his brother-in-law. In any event, it was in Seattle that Jack first logged on to the internet. He had heard about the internet the previous year from a fellow English teacher in Hangzhou called Bill Aho. Bill's son-in-law was working on an internet-related business, which Bill described. Jack recalled that it was Bill who first told him about the internet, but that he couldn't explain it clearly either. It sounded very strange. I couldn't really understand it either. In Seattle, Jack stayed at the house of Bill Aho's relatives, Dave and Dolores Selig. Jack was shown around the wealthier districts of the city, including the Queen Anne neighborhood. Dolores Selig recalled to the BBC that Jack was impressed by some of the larger houses on the hill. Jack would point at various houses and say, I'm going to buy that one, and that one, and that one. And we just laughed because they were very expensive houses. But he was impressed. Bill Aho remembered, at that time, he didn't have a nickel. Jack then met Bill Aho's son-in-law, Stuart Trusty, who had set up an internet consultancy called Virtual Broadcast Network, VBN, located in the U.S. Bank Building on Fifth Avenue near Pike Street in downtown Seattle. Jack came and I showed him what the internet was, Trusty recalled. Back then, the internet was largely a directory for governments and businesses, but he seemed excited. For Jack, the visit to Seattle was a transformative experience. It was my first trip to the States, the first time in my life I touched a keyboard and computers, the first time in my life I connected to the internet, and the first time I decided to leave as a teacher and start a company. Jack recalled his first online session. My friend Stuart said, Jack, this is internet. You can find whatever you can find through the internet. I say, really? So I searched the word beer. Very simple word. I don't know why I searched for beer, but I found American beer, Germany beer, and no Chinese beer. I was curious, so I searched China, and no China, no data. Intrigued, Jack asked Stuart for help. I talked to my friend. Why don't I make something about China? So we made a small, very ugly-looking page for the translation agency I listed on there. The site for Hope Translation was just text without any images, plus a telephone number and the price for translation work. Jack later recalled to the journalist Charlie Rose, "It was so shocking. We launched it 9:40 in the morning. 12:30, I got a phone call from my friend. Jack, you've got 5 emails. I said, what is email? 3 emails came from the United States, 1 from Japan, and 1 from Germany. Jack set about formulating the idea for a new business, helping Chinese companies find export channels online, and pitched the idea of a partnership with VBN. Stuart, who developed a love of Tai Chi from Jack, he still practices in Atlanta today, recalled Jack as intensely focused on work. We'd go down to the office, we'd do our work, and we'd get something to eat, go back home, maybe do more Tai Chi, and it was just that way, every day. No extracurricular activities. Jack's dealing with VBN weren't easy. Stuart asked for an upfront deposit of $200,000 to grant Jack the exclusive right to make web pages in China. When Jack explained that he had borrowed money to make the trip to the United States and was now penniless, Stuart signed the agreement without the deposit, but on the condition that Jack pay up as soon as possible, even enlisting Bill Aho and his wife as guarantors. To get home to Hangzhou, according to a local media report, Jack had to borrow funds from a Hangzhou student in the States, then fly to Shanghai. For his client in Tonglu, Jack returned to China empty-handed, with no deal to finance the proposed highway, but inside his suitcase he carried back with him a computer running the Intel 486 processor. It was the most advanced in China at that time. Back in Hangzhou, he set about building his concept of an online Yellow Pages. He named the business China Pages. In this, his second venture, he would dive headfirst into the entrepreneurial sea, leaving his teaching days behind. Chapter 5. China is coming on. If traditional industry and e-commerce successfully merge together, there will be no limit to China's next round of economic development. Jack Ma. Soon after returning from Seattle to Hangzhou, Jack resigned his position as a teacher at the Hangzhou Institute of Electronic Engineering. He had realized that his teaching days must end when he ran into the dean, who was riding his bicycle, carrying vegetables he had just bought from the market. The dean encouraged him to keep working hard at teaching, but looking at the bicycle and the vegetables, Jack realized that even if he were to become dean himself one day, this was a future he couldn't get excited about. His new dream wasn't teaching or translating. Fresh from his first contact with the internet, he would build an online index, in English, of businesses in China seeking customers overseas. As Stuart Trustee had noticed back in Seattle, Jack had a tremendous work ethic. To populate China Pages with entries, he toiled away collecting information on companies, which he would translate into English, then send along with photos to VBN in Seattle for uploading to the website. In March 1995, Jack convened a gathering of 24 of his night school students to present his concept and seek their advice, as well as their business. I asked the most active and capable people from my evening classes to my home. I talked about 2 hours. They listened to me, obviously confused. Eventually, lots of people cast their votes. 23 of them said it would not work out. Only one person, now he is working at Agricultural Bank of China, said to me, "If you want to try, then go ahead. But if it doesn't work out, come back as soon as you can." Undeterred, he pressed ahead. Together with his friend He Yibing, a computer science teacher at the institute Jack had just left, Jack launched China Pages. The two had met the year before when He Yibing was looking for someone to help him practice his English ahead of a training trip to Singapore. There, He Yibing gained exposure to the internet. When Jack returned from Seattle with a dream of building an internet company, the two decided to work together. China Pages. The company they registered, Hangzhou Haibo Network Consulting, HHNC, was one of the first in China devoted to the internet. To fund his startup, Jack borrowed money from his relatives, including his sister, brother-in-law, and parents. Jack's wife, Kathy, was the first employee. In April 1995, Jack and He Yibing opened the first office for China Pages in a 12-square-meter office building at 38 Winner Road. To portray their business as a solid concern, Jack and He Yibing printed up several versions of their business cards, each listing different positions that they would use depending on whom they were meeting. During the day, the two partners went out to find clients, returning in the evening to teach an introductory training course about the Information Superhighway. This class helped generate some of China Page's early customers. On May 10th, 1995, they registered the domain name ChinaPages.com in the United States. In July, they officially launched their website, which featured a red-framed map of Asia, with China highlighted under the title China Business Pages, the online China business directory. The website's homepage indicated ChinaPages.com was broadcast via Seattle, USA, from Hangzhou, the Garden City. The site featured tabs including What's New, What's Cool, Net Search, and Net Directory, and a link to Hope, his translation venture. China Pages started off as a family affair. Jack's wife, Kathy, her sister, Zhang Jin, and He Yibing's girlfriend all lent a hand. Jack's former students also provided a ready pool of talent for China Pages. Jane Jiang, Jiang Fang, whom Jack had taught at the Institute a few years earlier, took charge of customer service. One visitor to China Pages in those early days was Cui Luhai, who ran a computer animation business. Now a lecturer at the China Academy of Art, Cui commented, "I can still remember the first scene I saw when I walked into his office. It was a pretty empty space, with only one desk set up in the middle of the room. There was only one very old PC desktop surrounded by a lot of people." Cui learned that Jack had spent most of his money on registering the business, leaving little left over for hardware or other equipment. China Pages badly needed customers. Kathy signed up one of the first clients, who paid them 8,000 yuan, $960. The company received a boost when Hangzhou was selected in May to hold the Formula One Powerboat World Championship later that year, the first time the event would be held in China. Jack's venture won the contract to make the official website for the race. To win more clients, as with Hope Translation beforehand, Jack called on his former students to spread the word and bring in business. Two of them duly obliged. He Shengyang, a former student of Jack's, was working at the Qiangjiang law firm. Reluctant to list the firm's name on the internet, he gave Jack his personal phone number instead. To his surprise, he started to receive phone calls around the clock from prospective clients, many overseas, who told him they'd got his number from China Pages. The once skeptical lawyer started to think there might be something to Jack's story about the internet after all. Another former student was Zhou Lan, who had become Jack's secretary. Zhou was working at the Lakeview Hotel in Hangzhou when Jack made a website for them, featuring the hotel's brand-new 14-inch color TVs. Later that year, the United Nations held its fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing, attended by more than 17,000 participants, including First Lady Hillary Clinton. A number of delegates traveled on to Hangzhou after the conference. Booking rooms at the Lakeview, they told the hotel management it was the only hotel in Hangzhou they could find online. By the following spring, the hotel had sold more rooms in the first 3 months than the previous year, another demonstration of the power of the internet. Even with the help of Jack's former students, China Pages needed more clients if it was going to survive. But demonstrating what China Pages was all about was not easy, for one very basic reason. In Hangzhou, at the time, it was impossible to get online. Instead, Jack came up with an alternative approach. First, he spread the word through friends and contacts about what the internet could do for their business. He then asked those interested to send him marketing materials to introduce their companies and products. Next, Jack and his colleagues translated the materials and sent the material by mail to VBN in Seattle. VBN then designed the websites and put them online. They then printed out screenshots of the websites and mailed them to Hangzhou. Finally, Jack took the printed materials to his friends and announced that, although they couldn't check this themselves, their websites were now online. But without internet access in Hangzhou, it was a challenge even explaining to his customers what online actually meant. As sales pitches go, asking people who had never heard of the internet to fork over 20,000 renminbi, $2,400, up front to create, design, and host a website they could never see was a challenging one. Jack worried that people thought he was defrauding them. "I was treated like a con man for 3 years," he said. First connection. Finally, in the fall of 1995, Zhejiang Telecom started to provide internet access services in Hangzhou. By the end of the year, there were only 204 internet users in the whole province. But Jack was among them and was finally able to load a website in front of his first client, the Lakeview Hotel, on the 486 computer he'd brought back from Seattle in his suitcase. It took 3.5 hours to download the front page. I was so excited. Starting with Deng Xiaoping's reforms, China experienced an entrepreneurial explosion that began to replace Marx with the market, becoming a socialist country with Chinese characteristics. But this did not mean the Communist Party was going to ease up on a central pillar of its rule, the control of information. China has a long tradition of controlling information, but especially so under the rule of the Communist Party. It is surprising, therefore, that the country ever connected to the internet at all. The fact that it did illustrates the Chinese government's often contradictory desires to maintain control while simultaneously unlocking greater economic opportunities. Without the internet, Jack's vision of connecting entrepreneurs with global markets would have never been realized. On September 14, 1987, while Jack was still a university student, the very first email from China was sent by Professor Qian Tianbai at Peking University to Karlsruhe University in what was then West Germany. The email, in English and German, read, "Across the Great Wall, we can reach every corner in the world." The email was sent at 300 bits per second, BPS, an impossibly slow connection by today's typical consumer broadband speeds measured by the tens or hundreds of millions of BPS. It would be another 7 years before China was connected to the internet proper. While the Chinese government was thinking about what to do about the internet, wrestling with issues of ideology, control, and infrastructure, the U.S. government was pondering the wisdom of bringing a communist country online. In the end, it was not politicians, but scientists on both sides of the Pacific who took the lead. After years of efforts, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, in Menlo Park, California, connected with the Institute of High Energy Physics, IHEP, 5,800 miles away in Beijing. While this was just a connection between two institutions, other scientists wanted to set up their own links. Connecting SLAC-IHEP to the internet was a much easier solution than stringing up new links from other locations in the United States to IHEP. As Dr. Les Cottrell at SLAC recalled, "We explored this only to find out that the DOD, Department of Defense, the DOE, Department of Energy, the State Department, all were very concerned about this. But eventually the U.S. government agreed. They said, okay, you can do this as long as you tell everybody who is on the internet that China's coming on." Les wasn't quite sure how to tell everybody on the internet, but eventually it was agreed that he would send an email to a particular distribution list. On May 17, 1994, the first real internet connection to China was established. Although IHEP was host to China's first web pages, the internet soon became more than a privilege reserved for particle physicists. At the same time as this first connection was being established, China was on the verge of a massive expansion in its communications infrastructure, a policy it called informatization, Xinhua. China's communist rulers had watched the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990 with alarm, attributing it in part to the yawning technological gap that had opened up with the United States. At the beginning of 1994, China had only 27 million phone lines and 640,000 cell phones for a population of 1.2 billion. The early users of cell phones were either government officials or the getihu, who could afford to shell out $2,000 to buy one, with others making do with pagers. The Chinese government resolved to change this, seeing an improvement in telecommunications as a tangible improvement they could deliver in the lives of the masses. Just as King Henry IV of France cemented his legitimacy by putting a chicken on every dinner table on a Sunday, with Xinhua, the Chinese Communist Party began to roll out phone lines, then cell phones, then broadband connections to hundreds of millions of people. In 1993, Vice Premier Zhu Rongji launched the Golden Bridge Project to create an information and communications network spanning the whole country. In 1994, the government ended the monopoly of telecom services held by the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications, MPT. To inject some competition into the market, a second carrier, called China Unicom, was established. Other countries, starting with the United Kingdom, had used private capital to finance the competitors, taking on state-owned telecom incumbents. China, obsessed with control of information, could not contemplate this. 20 years on, it still hasn't, and opted instead to launch China Unicom as a new state-owned enterprise, backed by three other ministries and a number of other state-owned enterprises, effectively pitting one government department against a coalition of other departments in a uniquely Chinese approach to telecom deregulation. Spurred into action by the loss of its monopoly, the new minister of MPT, Wu Jichuan, responded with massive new investment in telecom infrastructure. During a visit by U.S. Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown to Beijing shortly after the first SLAC-IHEP internet connection was established, China signed an agreement with Sprint to set up a new internet connection linking Beijing and Shanghai with the United States. This was the beginning of the ChinaNet internet service provider link that would allow members of the public, including Jack, to dial up to the internet in China for the first time. China's first technology entrepreneurs. As word spread that China was finally investing in its telecom infrastructure, the country's first technology entrepreneurs began to emerge. Mostly U.S.-educated engineers, they started new ventures to help build out China's communications networks. One of the most prominent was James Ding, Ding Jian, a master's graduate in information science from the University of California, Los Angeles. After the suppression of pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square in June 1989, he and many other U.S.-educated Chinese instead shifted their hopes for radical political change in China to a faith in the power of technology to reshape the country. In 1993, James Ding joined forces with Beijing-born Edward Tian, Tian Suning, who had recently completed a PhD at Texas Tech, to co-found Asia Info. In 1995, they moved the company's operations to Beijing to work on the data network build-out for China's telcos, including China Telecom's ChinaNet dial-up internet access network. Edward Tian would go on to become a leading figure in China's telecom market, and both he and James Ding would become high-profile investors in the technology sector. In 1995, another influential Chinese technology firm, UT Starcom, was formed. Started by Chinese and Taiwanese entrepreneurs in the United States, the company soon set up its China operations in Hangzhou. UT Starcom would play an important role in spurring the growth of China's telecom market by promoting a low-cost mobile system called Little Smart, Xiaoling Tong. This success helped put Hangzhou on the map for investors as a technology hub. A key investor in UT Starcom in 1995 was the newly established Japanese investment fund SoftBank, a firm that 5 years later would start to play a critical role in the success of Alibaba. Founded by Japanese billionaire Masayoshi Son, SoftBank took a 30% stake in UT Starcom. UT Starcom was formed by the merger of Unitech Industries and Starcom Network Systems. Unitech's Taiwanese founder, Liu Hongyang, had studied with Masayoshi Son at the University of California, Berkeley. Starcom's co-founder, Chauncey Hsieh, went on to head SoftBank China Venture Capital, which led Masayoshi Son's investment in Alibaba in 2000. By late 1995, with China's telecom and internet build-out beginning to gain momentum, Jack and his customers were finally able to connect to the internet from Hangzhou using the ChinaNet service that had already been rolled out in Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. Soon after, Jack traveled back to the United States with Li Qi, his newly appointed chief engineer, to visit VBN in Seattle. On returning to China, they ended their venture with VBN, setting up their own servers and a new China Pages site. This helped cut costs, but boosting revenues was proving hard. In 1995, only 1.5 million personal computers were sold in China, mostly to business or government users. Priced at roughly $1,800, the PCs cost a fortune for average Chinese at the time. The costs of getting a fixed line installed and getting online, combined with a lack of awareness about what the internet actually was, meant that China Pages was having a hard time finding enough customers. Jack stepped up his efforts to evangelize the internet. He even enlisted Bill Gates, in a manner of speaking. In late 1995, Gates' book, The Road Ahead, became an instant bestseller in the United States, and soon after in China, too. Although the book hardly mentioned the World Wide Web, to convince prospective clients of the importance of the internet, Jack started citing a quote from Bill Gates: "The internet will change every aspect of human beings' lives." A useful marketing message for China Pages, Jack had, in fact, made it up, as he later confessed. In 1995, the world started to know Bill Gates. But if I said, "Jack Ma says that the internet will change every aspect of human beings' lives," who would believe it? But, he added, I believed that Bill Gates would definitely say it one day. Shortly after the book was released, Gates famously did realize the importance of the internet, dramatically stepping up Microsoft's efforts and releasing a second edition of the book with a much greater emphasis on the internet. Meanwhile, in Beijing, an entrepreneur, Jasmine Zhang, Zhang Xuxing, had started to attract growing media interest after founding in May 1995 one of China's first privately owned internet service businesses. She called her venture Ying Haiwei, a rough phonetic equivalent in Chinese of the English term information highway. Other China internet founders credit her as the source of inspiration for starting their own ventures. One told me, "One day I was driving to work and saw one of their billboard ads saying, 'How far is China away from the information highway?' 1,500 meters ahead," referring to the company's office. Building on a tradition of internal BBS, bulletin board systems, popular in leading academic institutions such as Tsinghua and Peking universities, the company started to serve a few hundred users keen to experience the internet, then mostly dominated by websites in English, and share comments in Chinese about what they were discovering. Back in Hangzhou, Jack stepped up his efforts to promote his own venture, scoring a breakthrough when the Zhejiang provincial government invited China Pages to build its website. The government official in charge of commissioning the website, Yang Jiangqing, later recalled his dealings with Jack. "The first time he came to my office, frankly speaking, as I understood him to be an internet guru, I didn't expect to meet such a young guy." Jack launched enthusiastically into an explanation of the internet. Yang recalled Jack talked nonstop for 2 hours. Although Yang indicated the government was unable to pay for the project as its impact was unknown, Jack and his team quickly built the site hosted by China Pages in cooperation with a local unit of Zhejiang Telecom called Hangzhou Difo Communications, a partnership that soon after would sour dramatically. The site was one of the first projects in a national initiative to bring the Chinese government online, generating a lot of publicity for Zhejiang. Within a few days, Yang received congratulatory emails from overseas, including from members of the U.S. Congress. The coverage also boosted Jack's profile. A local newspaper ran a feature story on his company and his dramatic first visit to the United States. But the publicity also triggered problems for Jack and the official who had commissioned him. One of Yang's colleagues reported him to the provincial government, accusing him of hobnobbing with a Goethehu. The disgruntled colleague's report thundered that government information dissemination was a serious issue. How could it be handled and published via a Goethehu? After encountering resistance at the local level, Jack started to spend most of his time in Beijing. There, he met up with Jasmine Gong of Ying Haiwei. The two did not hit it off, Jack later sharing his first impressions. "I thought if the internet's demise comes one day, hers will be earlier than mine. I was already very idealistic, but here was someone who was even more idealistic than me." Jack and his partner, He Yibing, set about raising the profile of China Pages in Beijing. Jack had brought with him some articles he had written about the internet and asked his friends to help publish them. In Beijing, thanks to a relationship with a driver at the publication who was introduced by a friend, he met Sun Yanjun, deputy editor-in-chief of China Trade News. Sun was impressed by China Pages and invited Jack to give a lecture about the internet to his colleagues. Afterward, he published a front-page article on Jack and his company. While Jack was good at gaining publicity, China Pages still wasn't winning much business, and its efforts to open doors with the central government came to naught. In July 1996, China's national broadcaster, China Central Television, broadcast a documentary called Ma Yun the Scholar, which showed Jack being rebuffed by a government official. The documentary was produced by Fan Qinman, married to the famous director Zhang Xingzhang, who had brought a number of Jin Zhang novels to the screen. Fan was also from Hangzhou and sympathetic to Jack's cause. As she filmed Jack getting shown the cold shoulder, Fan became increasingly concerned for Jack's prospects. He no longer had his base in Hangzhou and was crushed in Beijing. He was almost bankrupt. In the documentary, through a window to the Beijing streets outside, Jack made a resolution to himself. "In a few years, you won't treat me like this. In a few years, you will all know what I do. And I won't be in dire straits in Beijing." The problem for China Pages was that it really was just a directory. The site was pretty rudimentary, merely listings of a company's products for sale. There was no way for prospective customers to make purchases online, so there was a limit on what China Pages could charge for its services. Squeezed out. China Pages was running out of cash to meet its payroll. Switching sales staff to commission-based pay relieved the pressure for a while, as did a 10,000 yuan contract from a client in the textile industry. But China Pages was in a vulnerable state. Yet, things were about to get much worse. The company that had worked with China Pages to build the Zhejiang government website, Hangzhou D4 Communication, made a bid to take over the company. China Pages was a small, privately owned company, but Hangzhou D4 was a unit of powerful SOE Zhejiang Telecom. In February 1996, the two entered into a joint venture, D4 Hope. D4 had a 70% stake in the venture, investing 1.4 million renminbi, $170,000. Jack would remain the general manager, and China Pages would hold the remaining 30%, which was valued at 600,000 renminbi, $70,000. At the time, this seemed like a significant achievement for a tiny, cash-strapped company. Zhang Jinjian, then an official with Hangzhou Telecom, termed it the first merger and acquisition transaction in the history of China's internet. Local media provided positive coverage of the joint venture. But the reality was a lot more sinister. Jack had discovered that when working with China Pages on the Zhejiang government website, D4 had registered the domain name www.chinesepages.com, very similar to his own ventures, www.chinapages.com, and a new company called China Yellow Pages. Yet because D4 was a subsidiary of a powerful SOE, Jack couldn't fight back. Gritting his teeth, he had to give interviews with local media lauding the new venture. The establishment of D4 Highball will further strengthen China Pages. He concluded by saying, "We have every reason to believe, with the right policies of the party and the state, and with the tremendous support from every walk of life in the society, China Pages will surely achieve great success. China's information high-speed train will be faster and faster." Years later, after Alibaba had become successful, Jack was free to comment on the experience. China Pages was dwarfed by its new partner, and while Jack was the general manager, the position turned out to be of little value. When the joint venture was formed, disaster followed. They had 5 votes on the board, and we had 2. Whenever there was a board meeting, whatever ideas I put forward, if one of them voted against it, the rest of them followed suit. During 5 or 6 board meetings, none of our ideas were passed. Jack had lost control of his pioneering venture. At that time, I called myself a blind man riding on the back of blind tigers. Without knowing anything about technology or computers, I started the first company, and after years of terrible experience, we failed. The China Pages episode provided him with some important lessons, as well as good material for his speeches, such as, "It is difficult for an elephant to trample an ant to death as long as you can dodge well," and, "With good strategies, you will definitely survive. To this day, I've realized one thing. Don't be nervous if you face huge competition in the future." He would later draw on his experiences when taking Alibaba into battle against eBay in the David versus Goliath struggle that would raise his profile on the global stage. Jack also points to China Pages as influencing the way he would structure his subsequent ventures. "From then on, I have held a firm belief. When I start businesses in the future, I will never hold the controlling stake of a company, making those controlled by me suffer. I will give plenty of understanding and support to lower levels. I have never once had a controlling stake at Alibaba. I am proud of this. I am the CEO of the company because I lead it with my wisdom, courage, and resourcefulness, not capital." In November 1997, Jack convened an off-site meeting with the China Pages team in Tonglu, announcing that he was giving up his stake in China Pages and moving to Beijing, leaving his partner, He Yibing, as CEO. Jack's invented quote that the internet would change everything was right. The problem was he had launched his venture too soon. Jack put his dreams on hold, taking a job in Beijing at a unit of the Ministry of Foreign Trade and Economic Cooperation, MOFTEC. There he was like a fish out of water, counting the days until he could jump back into the entrepreneurial sea of China's internet, which was about to get a whole lot bigger.